Welcome to Prostate Cancer Update. This is medical oncologist Dr. Neil Love. One of the most important recent trends in clinical management of prostate cancer has been the very rapid integration of PSA doubling time as a key factor determining management of men with PSA-only relapse. One of the most influential related clinical research papers is work from Johns Hopkins, which previously changed the field with the so-called Pound paper. The principal investigator of this newer data set is Dr. Stephen Friedland, who met with me to discuss the clinical implications.
The big study we did was work I did with Alan Parton and Patrick Walsh, and really looked at their patients who had had radical prostatectomy at Hopkins. And what we did is we looked at men who had a PSA failure. And of those men, we eventually identified a cohort of 379 that had very clean doubling time. We knew their long-term outcomes with a mean follow-up of 10 years after surgery, and some men 15, 20 years after surgery. And we looked at which parameters within the first year or two at the time of recurrence, doubling time, how quickly their PSA became detectable, the 0.2 level, their Gleason score, a lot of other factors, and said which of those are the best predictors of ultimately dying from prostate cancer, whether it be 10, 15, 20 years down the road. And really, the doubling time was the key factor that was driving things, by far the strongest predictor. But we also found how quickly the PSA became detectable. Again, time to PSA recurrence was a significant predictor, with a cut point at 3 years or less, or greater than 3 years, as well as the Gleason score. Gleason 8 through 10 being higher Gleason, and 5 through 7 being lower Gleason. I wouldn't call Gleason 7 low grade, but lower than 8 through 10. And putting those three variables together, we're able to develop tables, very much like what the Parton tables do to predict pathology. We have Catan nomogram to PSA recurrence. Now we have tables that can help predict the risk of mortality, 15 years down the road. And I think it's an important thing to keep in mind who these patients are. And that's their patients treated at Hopkins. They're younger patients than typically were seen in that era. These patients are largely late 80s, early 90s. So the younger patients, average age of 59, but that's not that different than what a lot of us are seeing in our practices today. They're relatively healthy, and also by and large, salvage radiation and early hormonal therapy were very sparingly used in this population. So this is a beautiful kind of natural experiment of the natural history of PSA recurrence and what will happen to these men. And what I do is I sit down with the patient, I look at these tables and say, all right, this is your numbers if we don't do radiation and if we don't do early hormonal therapy. Now, I'm not sure I can change that by doing the radiation or hormones, but do we like these numbers? Did the way they treated you work? Let's just do it the same way. Or do we not like these numbers? Do we need to do something different? And obviously the trick is then what is that something if we don't like those numbers?
Could you clarify specifically what the cut point was or sort of what the magnitude was in terms of PSA doubling time?
Yeah, so the time it takes the PSA to go from 1 to 2, 2 to 4. PSA doubling time is really a continuous variable. So any cut points you do are going to be somewhat arbitrary. So in our data set, the cut points that really seemed to work the best was below 3 months, was really the highest risk group. The 3 to 9 month was the next group. And that group is also actually pretty high risk as well. You got to a 9 to 15 month group that was starting to get lower risk. And the lowest risk group was doubling time greater than 15 months. And that was calculated over the first 2 years after recurrence.
You would think that, you're not talking about thousands of men. This is a relatively small number.
Correct.
You would think there might be a lot of variation in what the actual numbers are compared to what you're getting out of your almost 400 patients.
Yeah, no, I think there is a lot of variation in just how you calculate doubling time. So that's why, while it is a continuous variable, if you told me absolutely this patient was 3 months and this patient absolutely was 4 months, I would say the patient with a 3 month doubling time is more likely to be in trouble. But if I think the doubling time's 4 months, then I get the next PSA value, and lo and behold, it actually was 3 months or actually was 5 months. A little bit of fudge in that, in terms of it's hard to say exactly what the doubling time is. And that's why I think it's nice, the end of the day, that we came up with kind of broad categories of doubling time.
Now, within this cohort of patients, what fraction of them died of prostate cancer, had rapidly progressive disease, and what fraction had more indolent disease?
At 16 years after recurrence, so quite a long time, about half the patients had died from prostate cancer at 16 years. Remember, this is a young, healthy cohort, 59-year-old men who on average we would expect to have 25 years to live. So they're an event, indolent cancer is all based upon the age of the patient. A slow-growing cancer in an 80-year-old, something we don't worry about. A slow-growing cancer in a 40-year-old is something we probably should worry about. So if you take a 59-year-old with a quote-unquote indolent cancer, okay, it may take him 15, 20 years to die, but if he's otherwise healthy, he's going to die from this cancer. So you actually look at the men who died in our study of any cause, whether it be prostate cancer, heart attack, whatever the cause, and you ask how many of those were due to prostate cancer. And the answer was 75%. So 75% of the men who died, died of prostate cancer.
What about competing causes of mortality and age? Are you able to factor that in?
We have, and that's actually, we're working on a follow-up study now where we've actually identified that when we no longer look at just prostate cancer death, but now look at all-cause death, dying of any cause, whether it be prostate cancer or not, now age becomes a significant predictor. As you would expect, older men more likely to die of other causes. But in terms of dying of prostate cancer, it didn't make a big difference. We did not see, at least in our series, that older men had more aggressive or less aggressive disease.
But, you know, in breast cancer and actually colon cancer, Peter Ravden's Adjuvant Online site factors in specifically what the 10-year risk is of dying of, you know, some other cause than breast cancer based on age taken from, right, you know, large databases. Is there something like that that can be factored into your model?
I think there can. We haven't done it formally, and that's something I'll look at with these patients and say, all right, this is your 15-year risk of dying of prostate cancer. In the tables, we have 5, 10, 15-year data. So we can say, all right, your 10-year data looks pretty good. Your 15-year data looks about 50-50, maybe not so great, but you're 80 years old. Unfortunately, you hate to talk fatalistic, but we all go something eventually. So what's the likelihood? And that's a tough decision that you need to have sitting with the patient. What's the likelihood that you're going to be around 10 years anyway, that this cancer looks like it probably won't get you for 10 to 15 years? What's the likelihood you're going to be around then anyway?
What's your take on what's happening right now in the United States in the community setting with men with PSA relapse? Do you think patients are being overtreated, undertreated, or about right?
I think some men are being overtreated, some men are being undertreated. I think using our data, as well as other people, I mean, Anthony D'Amico has done a phenomenal job, a lot of other people. We're certainly not the first to say doubling time is an important variable. A lot of people have shown that. But using those criteria, we can identify men that I think we really need to be more aggressive on. And the question is what? Ultimately, a clinical trial to answer that question. But I think there's also a lot of men who are getting early hormonal therapy that really, if you look at these tables, their 10, 15-year risk of death from prostate cancer with delayed hormones is exceptionally low. And those are the patients. And, you know, sometimes I hear doctors say, well, I'll treat them with intermittent hormonal therapy. Well, it's still hormonal therapy. It's still putting them at risk of the side effects. And this is a patient that probably can be spared any sort of treatment.
How would you define exceptionally low?
Doubling time greater than 15 months and recurrence greater than 3 years. In our study, that was a quarter of the patients that met those two criteria, and at 15 years after recurrence, we had zero deaths in that group. So not to say that every single patient is going to survive 15 years, but out of a quarter of our patients who met those criteria, we had not a single death with delayed hormonal therapy.
What about metastatic disease and symptomatic metastatic disease, particularly with symptoms, which could, right, affect quality of life? So maybe they don't die of prostate cancer, but they, right, have symptomatic metastatic prostate cancer. What was the incidence, for example, in that lower risk group of metastasis?
We didn't look at that specifically, but I mean, you can go back to the Pound data and look at what is the risk of metastatic disease in that group. And with the lowest risk group in that, the 7-year risk of being metastasis-free was around 80%. And that was based upon a doubling time at 15 months, recurrence 2 years or less, Gleason below 7. So if you now say, well, after 3 years, which is about, in our series, is about a third of the patients recurred late. And of those, usually with long doubling times, I think if you take even longer doubling times, say greater than 15 months, you can probably even do better than that. So it's not zero, you know, or 100% metastasis free. They are at risk of developing metastatic disease. And that's the patients where I think the other thing is we're looking at the first year or two after recurrence and trying to predict what's going to happen 10 years down the road. And to me, you know, the way I've thought about this is we have such a long natural history. It's like running a marathon. And the marathon starts at the time of PSA recurrence. And it ends when the patient dies of prostate cancer. And it's a race we all want the patient to lose. No one wants to win this race. But each year, 27,000 men win this race. Metastatic disease is a midway point on that race. And if you're trying to predict who's going to win the race, ideally, you need to watch the whole race. So what we're trying to do is watch the beginning of the race and predict what's going to happen long term. And we can do it reasonably well, but every now and then you're going to be fooled. Someone's going to start off kind of slow, long doubling time, late recurrence, everything looks like it's going great, and this guy's low risk, let's just watch it, not do anything, and then something's going to change. What that exactly is at a molecular level is a very interesting question, but I don't know. Clinically, their disease changes. Their PSA doubling time speeds up, looks like they're getting into trouble. And that's why you can't just say, all right, doubling time's long, don't worry about it, go off, have a nice life, come back 10 years from now, we'll check a PSA. You need to continue to follow the patients every 6, 12 months, whatever's your practice, to try and pick up those few percent of guys that will change their biology early enough that in theory you can do something about that.
For physicians who aren't going to actually consult the table, is there sort of a rule of thumb that would kind of get you, you know, most of the point of what you all were able to demonstrate? Is it mainly the doubling time, or really that doesn't give you enough information?
No, the doubling time really is the driving force. You actually look at our study, and again, it's one study. It's not the largest number of patients out there. But in one study, we asked the question, if you give me two patients, patient A and patient B, and make me pick which patient I think is going to die sooner, whether it be patient A or B, given a certain amount of information, if you tell me just the doubling time and nothing else about the patient, but only the doubling time and force me to guess, I'm going to say, okay, the guy with 3 months will die before the guy with 4 months, and then ask me how often I'm right. How often did I correctly predict the right patient? And the answer was, in our study, 81% of the time, we correctly picked the right patient based upon doubling time alone.
Using mainly the 3 months or 9 months?
This was as a continuous variable. So if you told me 3 and 3.1 months, I would say 3.0 months is faster than 3.1. So purely as a continuous variable. And then when you then tell me, did they recur early or late, and tell me their Gleason score, and I can put all that together, then I'm 84% correct. So you notice it budges. Okay, 84% is better than 81%, but it's not a huge difference. Really, that doubling time is really the driving force.
On the other end of the spectrum, what's sort of an absolute value of a doubling time that, you know, you can be pretty comfortable that the patient doesn't have aggressive disease that needs to be treated?
I mean, I think in our study, if your doubling time was greater than 15 months, the risk of dying of prostate cancer, certainly at 10 years, was extremely low. But it wasn't zero. It's like looking at absolute PSA. You can't say there's any value where, oh, you don't have cancer, don't worry about it. Same with doubling time. I don't think there's any value you could say at some point in the future you're not going to have a problem.
Can you describe maybe a typical clinical scenario where you mentioned you think there's some patients who are not being treated early enough, the kind of scenario where maybe physicians are kind of not picking up on the fact that the treatment might be indicated earlier than they think?
Yeah, and I mean, I think if you have a patient who has, you know, has a radical prostatectomy, and that's what our series was, so that's really what I'm talking about, but similar arguments would be made for radiation, though the secondary treatments become a little bit different. You have a patient who recurs, and he's 0.2 within a year now, and 3 months later, he's 0.4. So you're worried that his doubling time is 3 months. It's low values. You're not 100% confident. What, first off, I think some people will do, and not everyone, you know, certainly to say in general people do X is a very dangerous statement because there's a lot of heterogeneity out there. But I think some people won't check the PSA for 6 months. They really have a short doubling time. They've gone through a couple doublings, so that might be about to 0.8. I think there's some nice data in terms of salvage radiation from Andrew Stevenson in a multi-center group, as well as other people that were learning that radiation really works best at these low PSA values, 0.2, 0.3, and probably works best when you combine it with combined androgen blockade, though that is purely speculating based upon when we treat with the prostate intact. But again, I think you have a patient that you're worried about. It's a guy who has a PSA recurrence. He's young, he's healthy. You're worried that he's going to be at risk of dying. I want to be aggressive in this patient, and I'll do the combined androgen blockade with radiation, even with short doubling time. As I said, the Stevenson data is suggesting that some of those patients will still have a durable PSA response. And classically, the teaching is short doubling time equals metastatic disease equals untreatable. But they're finding they actually have a durable response to radiation, which says at least in some of these men, it may be a local only initially.
What prompts you to use combined blockade as opposed to just LHRH agonist monotherapy?
I think that stems from, again, extrapolations. We don't have great data for that salvage setting. We don't have great data for when the prostate's intact, LHRH versus combined. So it's really extrapolating from the metastatic data, where we see about a 10% survival benefit for combined androgen blockade using a non-steroidal antiandrogen. If you look at some of the prostate cancer trialist cooperative group data that includes cyproterone acetate, which is a steroidal antiandrogen, you're at a couple percent. Once you take that out of the mix, you're at about a 10% survival for metastatic. So it's all extrapolating for high volume disease that may have similar benefits in small volume disease, but ultimately we don't know. It's a purely extrapolation.
But you put it all together and that you use it.
I do, because again, I mean, that's a patient that I'm worried about, and I want to be aggressive. So to me, it's extremely unlikely that combined androgen blockade will be worse for that short period of time, 6, 12 months, and there's a possibility that it may be better. So I tend to give them the benefit of the doubt. I think if you have a patient who, you know, is 10 years out and their PSA has been slowly creeping along, it's 0.01, and, you know, a year later it's 0.02, and okay, eventually they reach 0.2. It's been detectable maybe for 5 years, but it took them 5 years to get to 0.2, and now he's 75, 78. That's a patient that probably we could do nothing and just sit and watch and continue to observe, and probably doesn't need any therapy, whether it be radiation or hormones. So, you know, I really try and use the data that's out there to be more aggressive in the men that I think are at highest risk of dying, that most need the therapy, and less aggressive in the lowest risk men. So it's not that I use this to be more aggressive or less aggressive. It answers both.
Once you decide that the patient needs to be treated, how do you approach the decision in terms of radiation therapy, hormonal therapy, or both?
I use a lot of salvage radiation. It's really the last chance that patient has a cure. Hormones can potentially delay time to metastatic disease in high-risk men. Jed Mal showed that using data from the Center for Prostate Disease Research. Whether it affects survival is still an open question, but can affect time to metastatic disease. However, the radiation has the potential actually to cure some patients. And we don't have long-term data on radiation. But, I mean, we know men that are 5, 6, 7 years later still with an undetectable PSA. Now, is that a cure or just kind of a remission? I mean, we get into a semantics game at that point. But I think, is there one shot at cure? So I tend to be very aggressive in that. And I think the side effects of salvage radiation are not that severe. I think if the patient is not continent yet from the radical prostatectomy, I'm hesitant to do radiation because I don't think he'll ever achieve continence. If he is continent and I radiate him, there may be a transient incontinence, but that will resolve. I think the effect on erectile function is relatively small, but these are issues that haven't been studied as well as the side effects of primary therapy.
And those patients who do get radiation therapy, do you generally just use that and then monitor, or do you also use hormone therapy?
If they're a patient I'm really worried about, which is, you know, kind of, I'm worried they've recurred earlier, that a higher Gleason score, other adverse signs, seminal vesicle invasion, that type of thing, I will use it with combined androgen blockade. The question is how long to leave them on the hormones. It's certainly not a lifelong hormones. You know, I don't have the answer to that. I wish I did. I guess my practice would be somewhere of 6 to 12 months of hormonal therapy. But what's the right answer? I just don't know, you know.
You mentioned intermittent androgen deprivation. Is that something that you use?
I generally do not. I'm not a fan. I know a lot of people are a fan, and, you know, fair enough. Personally, I'm not. Anecdotally, talking to a lot of people who like hormonal therapy will tell you the example of, I started a patient on intermittent hormonal therapy. His PSA became undetectable right away. I stopped the hormones, and 3 years later, now his PSA is slowly going back up to where it was, and then we'll hit him again with hormones. Well, in my opinion, that's probably a guy with a long doubling time that probably didn't need the hormone shot in the first place. So the doctor I'm talking to is trying to tell me, look, patient's been off therapy for 2 or 3 years. Isn't that wonderful? And my point is, well, in my practice, the guy would have never gotten the therapy in the first place, so he would have had the entire time off therapy. Whereas the guy with the really aggressive disease, I'm worried that in that patient, we know giving a 3-4 month injection of LHRH agonist lasts much longer than that. So I'm concerned that in that guy with the rapid doubling time, that not time off therapy, which is really the time you're not giving shots, but the time they have a normal testosterone level is actually exceedingly small, and that basically as soon as the testosterone becomes normal again, that PSA shoots right up. So you're really not buying them a lot of time off therapy. You may be buying them time off shots and save some money. And fair enough, we can talk about it from a cost-benefit analysis. But in terms of actual quality of life efforts, I'm not a fan. The real, you know, data out there, unfortunately, there's not a lot of data out there to say whether it improves, does not improve, worsens time overall survival. Unfortunately, we just don't, in my opinion, have great data on that. There's certainly a theoretical basic science reason to not completely wipe out the androgen-sensitive cells. Those may be your friends, help suppress the androgen-sensitive. I'm aware of that. But I think at this point, that's more theoretical concerns than actual.
What are the clinical trials out there looking at therapy of PSA relapse, both ones that are ongoing or maybe they've closed and you're waiting for data that you think it'll be important over the next few years?
Unfortunately, there's not a lot of good studies going on in PSA recurrence. There's some vaccine trials. There's one drug trial going on. But actually, Paul Schellhammer was recently at our institution, actually reviewed all that and basically said there's 2 studies ongoing to look at PSA recurrence. And part of the problem is, what is the endpoint you're going to use? We learned from Pound that median time from PSA recurrence to metastatic disease is 8 years. So nobody wants to do an 8-year study to say, on average, it's an 8-year. If you take our drug, it's now 12 years. It's a pretty significant benefit, but nobody wants to do a 12-year study. So there are studies looking at chemo and hormonal therapy in terms of PSA adjuvant, trying to delay PSA recurrence. And on one of those studies is an arm that's a delayed arm waiting until PSA recurrence and then treating with, I think it's chemo versus chemo plus hormones at the time of PSA recurrence in the context of kind of an adjuvant saying not only is chemo good, but if we do it, is it early, super early, or wait to PSA recurrence? Does that make a difference? Outside of that, there's just not a lot of good trials. It's a lot of small phase 1, phase 2 individual studies looking at diet, looking, Raj Pruthi just published a study from UNC looking at Celebrex, celecoxib in that. There's a study coming out of UCLA looking at pomegranate juice. A lot of small type studies, but there's not a lot of good studies.
What randomized trial data do we have, if any, actually looking at androgen deprivation and PSA relapse?
We really don't. I mean, we have the EPC study.
Of course, that was really adjuvant.
It's adjuvant, exactly.
So it's really not on PSA relapse.
Yeah, no. I mean, again, you have Messing, which was an adjuvant study.
I mean, it's really amazing because that's where people are being treated. So virtually everybody's being treated in a situation where there's no data.
Yep.
I think. Is that the way you see it?
That's how I see it. I mean, Jed Mile did the math about 5 years ago and estimated there's about 50,000 men a year with PSA recurrence. I think now we're diagnosing more. We're probably up to about 60,000 men a year with PSA recurrence, and we really have no prospective randomized trial as to what to do with these men. It's all retrospective studies, extrapolations from other populations.
You mentioned the EPC studies looking at bicalutamide 150 milligrams in the adjuvant setting for higher risk men. Can you talk about what your take is on that and whether you think that bicalutamide has a role in PSA-only relapse?
In terms of the study specifically, I mean, what they found is for patients treated, very interesting, the watchful waiting group. This is a multinational study with a lot of patients enrolled in Europe, Scandinavia, where watchful waiting was much more common than we do in the U.S., but I think it was very telling, the data. If you looked at men who underwent watchful waiting with locally advanced disease, they had a benefit when put on bicalutamide 150 in terms of survival benefit for men with advanced disease. But men with local-only disease actually had worse survival when put on bicalutamide 150. And if you actually look at the data for surgery and radiation, you also see a trend towards progression-free survival in the surgical patients put on bicalutamide 150. You see an overall survival benefit with locally advanced. With radiation, you see a survival benefit for locally advanced with bicalutamide 150. But we know high-risk radiation patients today are going to get hormones anyway. In that study, they didn't get combined hormonal therapy. So that replicates our prospective randomized trial. But for the low-risk patients, both surgery and radiation, we really don't see a benefit for bicalutamide 150. So to me, you know, there's nothing special about bicalutamide 150 over other hormonal therapy. What I mean is it's a little bit better tolerated, and I think not as aggressive therapy as an LHRH agonist. And basically, to me, if you buy into this continuum of efficacy, with combined androgen blockade being better than LHRH agonist, at least in the metastatic setting, if you buy into that, which I believe there's a benefit, I think it's modest, but I think it's real, then the concept you've believed in, and you're buying into this paradigm that more blockade is better than less blockade. And if you have a patient on bicalutamide 150 and they start to fail, the PSA rises, and you put them on an LHRH agonist, generally the PSA will go down. So what it says is LHRH agonist is more efficacious in terms of blocking the androgen receptor and blocking PSA production, tumor stimulation, than bicalutamide 150. So again, if you believe more is better, then LHRH agonist should be a better, more efficacious treatment than bicalutamide 150. Now, there's a lot more side effects, so there's trade-offs there. But in terms of purely cancer issues, I think what the bicalutamide 150 data says is in high-risk men, you're probably having a benefit. In low-risk men, you're probably not having a benefit. You may actually have a harm. And the stronger you block it, probably the more pronounced that's going to be. Probably, in my opinion, better benefit in high-risk men, less benefit, and maybe even more harm in low-risk men. And that's what you see. In the one study that is out there with PSA recurrence, looking at hormonal therapy, and granted it's a retrospective study, but Judd Miles' study came out a couple years ago from the Center for Prostate Disease Research, where they showed delayed metastatic disease, but only in high-risk men. Gleason 8 or higher, or doubling time less than 12 months. And only that subset had a benefit. So I think there is a role for hormonal therapy in that high, you know, whether it be, I tend to wait more for salvage than adjuvant. I don't think you've lost a lot of time, but waiting for the PSA to be 0.1, 0.2, and you've potentially bought some of the men time off therapy. And then also not, as we learned, not all high-risk patients based upon pathology will recur. And when they do recur, not all will have rapid doubling time. So I think you can buy a significant number of men, no therapy or dramatically delayed therapy without harming them. And the patients that really do need it are going to regress rapidly. You're not probably harming them by waiting a few months and waiting to see what happens.
What are some of the common questions that you receive from other urologists about this issue?
One of the big questions is in terms of radiation therapy. What is the role of radiation? Usually in my discussions, I'll bring up diet as well, so I get some questions about that. And then really get a fair number of questions about intermittent hormonal therapy, which we talked a little about, which I'm, again, not a fan of, but that's a personal preference type thing. Occasionally get some questions about the bicalutamide 150, which is some of the better data. Granted, it's adjuvant. It's not truly PSA recurrence, but at least there's somewhat similar data. We're not completely extrapolating from metastatic disease. I get a number of questions also technically about PSA doubling time. How do you calculate it? How many PSA values? When do you start counting that? A lot of, you know, more statistically oriented logistical questions regarding, because I think a lot of people are now becoming aware, even out in the community, how fast the PSA rises is a very important predictor. If it rises fast, that's a bad sign. Slow rises, a less bad sign, less worrisome. But exactly how we take these 3-4 values sitting in front of us, or even the 2 values, and compute a doubling time. Is that a doubling time that's real? Do we believe that? How much faith can we put in those couple readings? I get a lot of questions regarding that.
Anything on the horizon in terms of being able to better identify men who need more aggressive therapy, whether it's primary disease or PSA recurrence, or a lot of exciting things have happened in other tumors in terms of genomic analyses and proteomics? Right. What's going on in prostate cancer?
I mean, there's a lot going on, but I think it's not ready for prime time at this point. There's some very interesting work that was done out of Michigan looking at autoantibodies in prostate cancer, but more as a diagnostic tool. You know, Rob Getzenberg at Hopkins has done a lot looking at various markers. People are looking at AMACR, A-M-A-C-R, which is alpha-methyl-acyl-CoA racemase, and looking at levels of that. DD3, which is now UPM3, is commercially available, trying to use that as a prognostic tool. So there's a lot of things on the horizon, but in terms of routine clinical care in 2006, PSA and PSA kinetics is one of the best. And Gleason score. I mean, Gleason score is a pretty valuable predictor. And then tumor burden, you know, if you have 12 out of 12 cores, even if it's a Gleason 6, low PSA, that's a high volume disease. That patient scares me.
What's your take on the data that's come out over the last couple of years in terms of chemotherapy with prostate cancer, specifically the docetaxel data in metastatic disease, in terms of what kind of clinical benefit you think it provides to patients with metastatic disease, and where you think that might be heading in terms of trying to use it earlier?
Well, I mean, as you know, there were two large studies that were published in New England Journal, and basically both of them showed that relative to treatment with mitoxantrone and prednisone, which was the FDA-approved standard of care for men with hormone-refractory metastatic prostate cancer, treatment with docetaxel plus prednisone every 3 weeks resulted in about 2 months survival advantage, from about 16 months to 18 months. So the question is, how important is a 2 month survival benefit? I think rather than ask that question, the way to look at it is we have a drug that we know works. In the latest of late stages, hormone refractory, metastatic disease, a year and a half to live, we have benefit. There was a study that came out in JCO about 2 years ago that showed for men with PSA recurrence, the docetaxel by itself is active. Significant reductions in PSA. So we have an active drug, then the latest of late stages improves survival. So now the key question is exactly as you said, trying to ask if we use this earlier, can we have a similar 15% survival benefit? So if you treat when the patient has 5 years left to live, can we see, you know, nearly a year, 8-9 months improvement in survival by using it earlier? And I think what it's done very nicely is it's gotten the medical oncologists very interested in clinical trials in prostate. And we weren't having a lot of those. And I think as we're seeing from other cancers out there, mainly what we're seeing with renal cell, with some of these PDGF, VEGF inhibitors that have tremendous activity in renal cell. I mean, prostate cancer is also a vascular tumor when it's at the metastatic phase. And so those drugs may have a role in prostate cancer. So I think we're learning a lot from other cancers, and now we're poised to start asking some important questions.
I want to get back to the chemo, but as long as you brought up that issue of vascularity, what do we know about the VEGF pathway in prostate cancer compared to other tumors?
It's actually activated and it's involved. I mean, certainly not as much as renal cell. And I think, you know, any urologist who's taken out a big metastatic renal cell, you know, with those huge veins that you get with that will clearly know that intuitively. But it is a vascular tumor. And if you actually look at VEGF levels and rank them by tumors, prostate is one of the highest. Clearly, renal cell is up at the top of the list, but prostate is. So, I mean, there's every reason to believe that those inhibitors may have a role in prostate cancer as well.
Getting back to the issue of chemotherapy, and particularly docetaxel, what have you observed, you know, as a non-oncologist? Sometimes people think oncologists maybe minimize the side effects of treatment.
Right.
When you've sent your patients to an oncologist to get docetaxel-based chemotherapy, and then you see them back, how do they seem to tolerate it?
I mean, I think it's a tough therapy. You know, it's not for everyone. Unfortunately, I mean, it has benefit. So, you know, you would like to give it to people in terms of both quality of life, pain reduction. So it's not just make them miserable and extend 2 months of miserable life. It actually improves quality of life. But really, you need an oncologist who's familiar with it and can get them through it. And usually, by that point, I've largely turned over all their care, for the most part, to the medical oncologist. So I'm not always seeing them back at that stage.
Are there any situations with PSA-only disease, young patient who's hormone refractory, clearly, where you could see justifying maybe a very short doubling time using chemotherapy off protocol for PSA-only disease?
I think that's reasonable, especially in the hormone refractory setting. I mean, the question is, what are your alternatives? And really, at this point, we don't have alternatives. Clinical trial, I mean, very strongly support clinical trials. And there are clinical trials for men with hormone refractory PSA recurrence. I mean, I can't tell you all of them, but there's a number of trials. A lot of phase one, different centers are doing small phase twos. So I think there are a lot of options. And most of them are built off docetaxel. So it would be docetaxel plus X versus docetaxel alone, or docetaxel plus X versus X alone. And generally, X is something that's felt to be an active agent, generally doesn't get to the point of clinical trials unless there's some belief that it's going to have a benefit. And that's where I think the docetaxel data has changed the face of clinical trials, that historically it was always X versus placebo. Because, I mean, we didn't really have anything proven survival benefit. And now everything has to be compared to docetaxel or combined with docetaxel.
Are there any systemic agents that you've seen data that you find encouraging that maybe you think in the next few years are going to be utilized in prostate cancer?
In terms of late stage or prevention or?
No, for active disease.
Active disease. As I said, I'm very intrigued by some of these, the VEGF pathway. I think the mTOR pathway is another one that's being looked at a lot in prostate cancer, as we're learning, is an important pathway. Those are probably two of the most, I would say, targeted therapies that I can think of. In terms of just straight chemotherapy, I mean, we're not doing as much. I mean, we have docetaxel, and we're kind of building off that. So those would be kind of the two key pathways, I'd say.
Any other areas of clinical or research interest that you have in prostate cancer?
Yeah, I'm very interested in what is the association with obesity and prostate cancer. And, you know, obesity is an epidemic in the United States. It affects 1 out of 3 adults in America. And there's very good epidemiological data to say obese men are about 20 to 30% more likely to die from prostate cancer. And so the question is, why is that? That's data that actually dates back to the 1960s. So now there's been a lot talked about in terms of, well, it's harder to operate on them, PSAs may be lower, we may be missing cancers, a lot of data regarding that. And while all true, I mean, the 1960s, we didn't have PSA, we weren't doing radical prostatectomies, we didn't have chemotherapy, you know, we didn't have statin therapy to reduce the risk of cardiac disease among obese men, and yet still they were about 20 to 30% more likely to die of prostate cancer, despite being more likely to die of everything else. So I think there truly is biology there, and I'm very intrigued by that. If you look at obese men, some of the hormonal changes, they have lower testosterone levels, higher estrogen levels. Generally, it's a poor diet, excess calories, high fat, high carbohydrate. You get changes in other hormones, high insulin. So trying to pinpoint which factor it is becomes very intriguing. I think once we do figure it out, it's going to give us some valuable insight into prostate cancer in general.
Now, is this mainly related to whether you develop prostate cancer or once you develop what the course will be?
Both. Both. And there's actually some interesting data coming out that obese men may actually be less likely to be diagnosed with prostate cancer, but the cancers that they have are more aggressive, which is very interesting in and of itself. And is that just a low testosterone that it prevents some indolent, but yet promotes the more aggressive cancers, the T to E ratio? Is it everything else, as I said, the insulin, the diet? It's very intriguing, but it's kind of a lifelong study there.
In the 2005 ASCO meeting, there was an intriguing presentation on breast cancer, a randomized study looking at lowering dietary fat intake, demonstrating reduced relapse rates. A really shocking study, the WIND study. Mm-hmm. Has that been looked at in prostate cancer?
It is not. And I think, you know, one important point about that WIND study that was designed purely as a low-fat versus standard diet, the women on the low-fat diet lost weight. They lost on average about 4 pounds. So we know from animal data that caloric restriction, taking in fewer calories, which will result in weight loss, is very anti-tumor. So whether that is due to the low-fat diet that they took, i.e. fat in and of itself is bad, or to the fact they lost weight, i.e. took in fewer calories, that delayed the breast cancer recurrence. At this point, given the data is not published, we haven't really seen detailed analysis, I can't answer. But in terms of men, there is some data. Dean Ornish out at UCSF did a study that came out in the Journal of Urology about a year ago, give or take, that put men on an extremely low-fat diet with lifestyle intervention, yoga, exercise, the full works, essentially, randomized trial in men with prostate cancer on watchful waiting. So they had an intact prostate, had PSA values that they could measure. And what they showed is that men after a year on their treatment arm had a significant, albeit extremely modest, reduction in PSA of about 7%. Statistically significant, yes. Clinically significant, I don't know. The men who were on the standard therapy had a slight increase in PSA values. So it's the end of the year, there were differences between the two groups. But again, what is the clinical relevance of that given only, you know, over a year, this very intensive lifestyle intervention with very modest changes in PSA? I just don't know whether long-term how that's going to pan out. We saw some very interesting changes in the serum when that was actually put on cancer cells. Cancer cells grew much more slowly in a petri dish from serum from men who are on the intervention arm. Very intriguing that we may be slowing the growth of the cancer, but when you start taking serum from men and putting it on someone else's cancer cells in a petri dish, at the end of the day, what that means, I don't know. It's very intriguing data. But again, I'm just not sure what that means. But we have not seen, you know, to get back to the specific question, not seen any specific data on men with prostate cancer randomized to a low-fat, large study like they did with the WINS. It'd be great if we could get that up and running in prostate. And that's something I'm interested in doing, but it's trying to marshal all the effort to do that.
Right now in your own practice, when you have a patient who has prostate cancer, do you provide any input or advice about lifestyle, diet, exercise, et cetera, particularly as it relates to the possibility of recurrence?
Absolutely, I do. If you look at men with prostate cancer, we know lifetime risk is about 1 in 6. It's about 16% of men will get prostate cancer. About 2%, give or take, of all men will die of prostate cancer. So ballpark numbers, about 5 out of 6 men who are diagnosed with prostate cancer will die of something else. Now, whether that's because we picked it up early and did a very nice radical prostatectomy or irradiated it, I don't know. Just numerically, 5 out of 6 men with prostate cancer will die of something else. And so you ask the question, what's the number one cause of death in those men? It's heart disease. How do we prevent heart disease? Put them on a healthy diet and tell them to exercise. And to me, a healthy diet is low animal fat, and if you are going to have animal fat, ideally chicken and fish, a lot of vegetables. Tell them to try and cut down on simple carbohydrates, the sugars, the cookies, your refined pastas, that type of stuff, because I think simple carbohydrates will spike your insulin levels, which I think is bad for both the heart and your prostate. And tell them, basically, look, this is something that's going to help your heart. Whether it's going to help your prostate or not, I don't know. My bias, my guess, is that it probably will. Certainly, it's highly unlikely to be bad for your prostate. And I think for a lot of these guys, we do a blood test and we tell them their PSA is high. We do a biopsy. They sit there while we do the biopsy. And then they sit there while we either radiate them or take out their prostate. They're very, in a lot of ways, passive player in this game that we're playing here with the PSA and the cancer and everything. And to me, diet is one thing that they can really take control of and be in charge of them and let them take an active role in their own therapy. So I think a lot of men really jump at that. And again, whether I'm helping their prostate or not, I don't know. I think I am. I'm probably not harming it, but I know I'm helping their heart.
What about the issue of exercise? Again, at that 2000 ASCO meeting, it was a fascinating study given that it was kind of a retrospective analysis of an adjuvant trial in colon cancer showing a dramatic correlation between relapse rate and exercise. The patients who exercised, I think it was like 3 hours a week of walking or something like that, had 50% fewer relapses. All the caveats of, you know, a retrospective analysis,
right, sure.
Still pretty dramatic. What do we know about exercise and prostate cancer?
We know very little. There are studies that show exercise improves quality of life among men with late stage disease, which is not surprising, getting them physically active, moving. In terms of actual survivorship or incidence, it's all cohort data, prospective cohort data, where it's measured kind of in real time, but not in the context of a clinical trial. And again, I think that kind of goes into the healthy living, trying to maintain a normal BMI, body mass index. As I said, I think that body mass index in and of itself, we could debate how good of a marker that is, but I think is a surrogate of kind of what's going on with the patient in terms of their exercise, their dietary patterns. So I think maintaining a normal weight, which combined healthy diet and exercise, can help prevent some of this fatal prostate cancer. And there's some data that physical activity may benefit. If you look at the prospective cohort data, it seems to benefit some men, which doesn't completely make sense that it only benefits some men and not others, but at least that's the limited data we have out there.
You know, sort of following along this theme of looking at the total health of patients, what about the patient who's on androgen deprivation? To what extent are you concerned about cardiovascular disease, about bone, et cetera?
I'm very concerned about it. And that's why for that low-risk patient, I don't even want to start him on the hormones in the first place. We know from other studies that androgen deprivation can lead to insulin resistance, which taken the next level would lead to increased risk of diabetes, which we're starting to see in some studies, can affect cholesterol levels unfavorably so. So if you put in insulin resistance, changes in cholesterol, I think it's only a natural next step to say that there may be cardiac morbidity and even mortality. And I think in the next couple of years, we're going to start to see some data from that. I know Matt Smith up in Boston has done a lot of work on that. Anthony D'Amico is doing some work on that as well now, trying to identify exactly to what degree this hormones. I think a lot of people have looked at the benefits of hormones, which I think are still an evolving field, but we're starting to get a better handle on. But now, what are the downsides to hormones? And again, it all comes back to risk-benefit profile. But I'm very concerned, especially in an older patient who's more likely to have cardiac comorbidities to begin with, more likely to die of other causes, i.e. less likely to die from prostate cancer, putting those patients on hormonal therapy, I'm very worried about it. We also have the bone health issues, as you mentioned, and clearly osteoporosis develops. And I mean, it's interesting because you ask the question, well, if osteoporosis is such a problem, it should lead to fractures. So the question is, how often do you see fractures in these men? And in my practice, I see very few. You know, and I actually had a discussion with that, actually with Bill Nelson, who's a medical oncologist at Hopkins, and saying, I'm not seeing a lot of fractures. Basically, his comment to me is say, you're not looking for them. The guy who comes in with a little bit worsening of back pain, you say it's the cancer, here, take some extra medicine. But if you actually do the x-rays, that's probably a fracture. So I think it's probably a lot more common than certainly I realize, and I think a lot of us probably realize. And you know, the medical oncologists are probably a little bit more in tune to this in general than a lot of the urologists I know.
Yeah, Matt Smith makes that exact point, that when you ask most urologists, they say just what you said. Well, geez, right. I haven't really seen it. And yet he feels the data is very conclusive that, you know, it's there.
No, absolutely. And that's why it's interesting talking to Matt, who's a medical oncologist, Bill Nelson, some of these medical oncologists, they say absolutely they see it. It's just, I mean, you only look for what you know and you only see what you look for.
What about the issue of decreased activity in men on androgen deprivation? To what extent do you see that as an issue?
You definitely get some lethargy. You can get memory loss. You can get fat deposition, the bone loss, which I think coupled just decreased energy, which going back to our earlier discussion in terms of physical activity being a good thing for these men in terms of both quality of life and potentially quantity of life, if we can wrap it around some weight loss, caloric restriction, and now you're giving a therapy that's going to decrease the likelihood he's going to go out and exercise, you know, you got to be very conscientious about this. And that's why, again, while clearly a role for hormones, we need to understand these are very potent drugs. It's not just, oh, we'll give you a little hormones, we'll keep your PSA down, and everyone will feel good. Okay, PSA is down, they feel good from that, but yet they have memory loss, loss of libido, muscle loss. There's a lot of other reasons they're going to feel bad because of the hormones.
So are you actually doing research on obesity right now?
We are. We actually are doing several aspects on obesity. One is to continue to look at the clinical data. I'm actually working with Carmen Rodriguez of the American Cancer Society, looking at one of their cohorts to look at how obesity affects prostate cancer. As I said, we're actually seeing that obese men are less likely to be diagnosed with your low stage, low grade, but actually more likely to be diagnosed with low stage, high grade, and metastatic disease. And I think part of that may relate to this lower PSA values obese men have. We're just missing some of the cancers. We've shown obese men have bigger prostates. Again, you may be missing it at the time of biopsy. It's a lot of biases that can come into the system. So we're continuing to look at that clinical data. We're also doing studies looking at different diets and how that affects prostate cancer growth. And it's actually very, I guess, fortuitous for me in terms of my own personal health, in that starting studying obesity and thinking about it and really getting very intrigued by the idea that insulin may be the culprit as much as any factor. And insulin obviously is a hormone that goes up when we eat carbohydrates. So really starting to think that carbohydrates may be the enemy. And actually, based upon my research, really kind of spanned over into my personal life, about a year ago, stopped eating a lot of the carbohydrates, the cookies, the ice cream that I was eating. And actually, you know, it's nice to sit here today and say I've actually lost 60 pounds.
Wow, really?
Yeah, based upon my own personal changes. And I'm not doing Atkins. I'm not doing South Beach diet either. It's kind of a Friedland modified diet. I don't even know what to call it. But just cut down on the amount of food, started studying caloric restriction. It extends survival in animal models. Monkeys as well, carbohydrates being bad, and just kind of modified my own diet.
And that's fascinating. And since we're using an audio media here, how tall are you and how much do you weigh right now?
I'm about 5'11", 5'11 and a half. I like to say 6 foot on a good day. And I was 213 pounds, which gave me a BMI right around 29.5, give or take, right on the cusp of being obese, which would be above 30. That's when, again, I got scared, started changing my diet, and now I'm about 154 or so.
And had you ever tried to lose weight before?
Not to this degree. I mean, in college, you know, you go on a crash diet, you lose 20 pounds. I'd always been able to lose weight, but it's actually interesting. You know, as I got into this, I'm actually working with an MD, PhD student at Duke who's Greek, last name Mavropoulos, and actually came to me as we were studying diet and says, you know what the word diet means in Greek? I'm like, you know, I really have no idea. And he's like, it means way of life. It doesn't mean a crash change in your eating habits to lose 20 pounds to look good in the dress or for some summer on the beach or anything. It's a way of life. And so I kind of took that to heart, you know, about a year ago and said, all right, my lifestyle is not a healthy lifestyle. I'm just going to change my way of life. And so people come up to me and like, well, how much weight do you want to lose? I said, I don't know. This is how I want to eat. This is what I think healthy eating is, and my body will tell me what it wants to weigh.